Hello and welcome to Star Trek Panel to Panel. This is Jeremy Bement, your host, welcoming you to a new episode of Star Trek Panel to Panel, brought to you by Hero Collector and Eagle Moss Collections, the people that bring you the Star Trek collected graphic novels. In this episode of Star Trek Panel to Panel, we are going to take a look at one of these volumes. It's volume 11. Some of you might have this in just the regular soft cover trade paperback that IDW put out a while back. This is a story called Star Trek, The Next Generation, Intelligence Gathering. And we are going to do a deep dive into this story. I will give you a quick review of it, and then we will have a wonderful chat with the writers of this story, Scott and David Tipton. So, with this intro out of the way, let's get into the meat of this episode right after this. Earlier this week, I was talking with somebody who I discovered was a comic book fan that I had no idea that they were. And I used to be a comic book retailer back in the day. I did that for 15 years, over 15 years. And we were talking about how many long boxes of comics that we have or had. At one point, I was up to probably about 30, 35 long boxes of comics. This person I was talking to, they said at one point they had up to 50 long boxes of comics. And you know, that's an awful lot of long boxes to dig through. I've reached the point now where I still buy comics. It's kind of infrequently, not as often, or I don't buy as many as I used to. And I've been buying more collected editions, more trade paperbacks. I'm not so much into the value of the comics themselves. I want to read the story and see the artwork and just enjoy it for the comic that it is. And when it comes to Star Trek comics, I don't have all that many, and I'm working my way through getting, I want to read them all. I enjoy Star Trek. I've been a Star Trek fan since I was a little kid, watching it as reruns on my local TV station when I would get home from school. And the fine folks at Hero Collector are putting all the Star Trek comics all together in these wonderful hardcover graphic novel collections. It's a subscription service. And it's easy for you to sign up. Just go to herocollector.com, and right there on their main page, there's a link for the Star Trek graphic novels. They're reprinting all these in nice hardcovers. I'm one of those people who's anal about the fact that I like to have all my spines match if it's a series of something. And not only do all these spines match, but they have nice pictures of various different starships and alien ships from all the different alien races of Star Trek that make a big giant picture when you put all these graphic novels together. I just started getting these not too long ago, and Hero Collector is nice enough to sponsor this podcast as we dive into these books and find out more about the behind-the-scenes, the director's notes, if you will, for these books as they're coming out. So if you're somebody like me who hasn't read all that many Star Trek comics, well, over the years I have, but I want to, you know, read them all together, just one book after another after another. Instead of having to dig through lots of long boxes and try to find all those issues, check out herocollector.com. See if you can get signed up for their subscription service, and I promise you won't regret it. These books are awesome.
Incoming transmission.
Star Trek The Next Generation is probably my favorite era of Star Trek. It was airing on TV at just the right point in time for me. You know, I was a kid of the 70s. I grew up watching classic Trek reruns. Which I love, but it was as a young adult, late teenager, young adult, when Star Trek Next Generation came on the air, that I grew to appreciate the stories and that they were telling. I grew to love the cast of characters. I love all of them. And so going and checking out this miniseries, or this collected edition from Hero Collector, Star Trek The Next Generation Intelligence Gathering, was a treat for me. It was going back, going home, going back and revisiting the cast of characters that I enjoyed. Like I said, this story came out quite a while back from IDW. It was written by the Scott and David Tipton, the Tipton brothers, with art by David Messina and Gianluigi Gregorini, and coloring by Ilaria Traversi and Elena Casagrande. This story, basically, as you'll hear as we in the chat coming up with Scott and David Tipton, basically is a chase through space due to what happens in the first part of the story. It does a nice job of kind of showcasing various different characters or pairings of characters, And it leads to a fairly satisfying conclusion. It's basically a big space chase with little interludes kind of thrown in. Each issue or part of the story has its own kind of separate goings-on, and there's this underlying story arc of something happens and it's up to the crew of the Enterprise to figure out who done it. I thought it was a fun story. It is set during one of my favorite years of Next Generation, where you get a lot of these kind of stories where you might have a couple of stories where the entire Next Generation cast is the focus of the story, and it's a fairly substantial story to kind of for their overlying arc for the season. But then you also have episodes that focus on, say, Geordi, for example, or a Data-centric story, or one about Counselor Troi, or one about Worf. This miniseries that the Tipton brothers did an excellent job of capturing that feel of kind of an addition to the season that they're setting the story in. As you'll hear from when I chat with the Tipton brothers, a lot of these issues or the parts of the story felt very much like they would fit right into a season of Next Generation, which is always a good thing because although I'm reading a comic or a Star Trek comic, I want to have that feel like I'm watching a Star Trek episode as well. I want to feel like I'm back in the day when it was on the air and I'm visually watching something that I can picture on my TV screen. And I think the Tipton brothers did an excellent job of that with the story that they told, along with David Messina's artwork, which you can tell he's still fresh out of the gate. I don't think he's been, when this story was done, he had been doing comic art for all that long. And if you compare this artwork to his more recent stuff, you can definitely see where his skill as an artist has grown by leaps and bounds. However, I don't want to sell David short on this. His artwork definitely fits the story well. He does a good job of capturing likenesses, which I think is always a plus when it comes to a licensed comic. And all in all, the combination of the Tipton brothers and David Messina is a win-win situation for me. So, Intelligence Gathering, I give it two big thumbs up. I think that if you haven't read it yet, give it a read. I think you'll enjoy it. And with this little review out of the way, let's go into a conversation with Scott and David Tipton. Today on Star Trek Panel to Panel, we are going to take a look at the Next Generation story, Intelligence Gathering. And joining me to talk about it are the co-writers of the story, Scott and David Tipton. Hi, guys.
Hello.
How you doing? How you doing? Good to see you.
Here you go.
Doing good. So this story, you wrote it quite a while back. You had done some previous stories for IDW before this one came about. Do you remember exactly how you did you pitch this Next Generation story, or did the editor come to you and say, hey, we want to do a Next Gen story?
This would have been like, what, 2009, Dave?
It's 2008. I just looked up. So it's
okay.
12 years ago. Yeah, that's a long
That's a while back.
If I could get in the Wayback Machine for a minute and think about it, I think we had done the Gorn, one shot, and then we did our Klingon series.
Okay.
And I think we followed up the Klingon series with the
Orion one shot.
Right, and then the Mirror, and while that was all happening, David Tishman had the first Next Gen miniseries going on.
Okay.
And then so by the time we were done with our first couple things, his book wrapped up, and then I think we pitched for it. I don't think they asked us. Do you remember, David?
Yeah, I think this was after Blood Will Tell, and this was when we did after that, and they were looking for a Next-Gen series.
Yeah,
so
and they knew we were interested.
It's a Next-Gen series. Yeah. And, you know, looking over it today, and we'll get into it, but it's very much a story of the time. You can see kind of that things like Buffy-type monsters were in at the time.
Yeah.
By the time you get to the end of this story. So it's definitely a story from 2008 in certain ways, yes.
Okay. Well, go ahead.
Oh, please, go ahead, Jeremy.
Oh, I was just wondering, going in, how did you come up with the idea for this? Were you trying to do like the story lays out as you have five parts where the first four parts kind of focused on different cast members?
I think what I do, the one thing I do recall for sure, this is kind of where we, the origin of our philosophy that we wanted to try to make these really feel like episodes.
Okay.
So I think what I remember, and correct me if I'm wrong, David, I know we wanted to do like, you know, five kind of filmable episodes, but then find a way to tie them all together into a larger story.
Yeah, and also I think we had gone into it with a mindset of we wanted to do a certain set types of stories. We wanted to do a sort of virtual reality story, and I think we opened up with that one.
Yeah.
We wanted to do a Worf story. So we had some set ideas, and then we wanted something to pull it all together. And that's how the Tomalak story came about, was, okay, what can we use as a common thread to bring these together? Because we wanted to do, like Scott said, we wanted to really tell the story in the form of real episodes, but we also wanted to have a five-story arc that would work for a trade publication later on, too.
Sure.
Because if you look at, like, the seasons of the original of the TNG series, you would have, say, in a given season, you might have three or four Geordi stories, and you might have three or four Bev and Troy stories. And so we only had, like, was this a 5-issue or a 6-issue?
Five.
We only had five. We thought, okay, we'll get a couple of really big focus stories, and then we'll do a Geordi, and we'll do a Worf, and we'll do a Riker and Data, and then not really focus. It surprised me because I looked at this a couple of days ago for the first time, I think, since 2008. And there's not a lot of Picard focus on it. He's around, but you wouldn't say this is a Picard story.
Yeah, very true. And I thought that you did a really good job of kind of encompassing the feel of it. This is set during year five of Next Generation, and you did a good job of making it feel like it fits within that season. And why did you decide to use that particular time frame? Was it because you wanted the to see the people with the high collars, or make sure that Riker had his beard and not the clean shaven Riker?
Do you remember anything that you
I'm
want
thinking?
To focus on?
I think part of it was we wanted to set it so that we could use the Iconian, so it had to be after season two.
Yeah.
And that's how these things always roll, is that when you set a story within Star Trek, then you've got to figure out, okay, how does it fit within the seasons? Because if you're off on that, you're going to get called on it. So it has to fit the story almost all the way in. So it has to be after season two. And then for some reasons, we must have decided we wanted it before a certain season. So that's like how I think it worked out.
Yeah. Okay. If there are story elements you want, you have to make sure you can tell your story after that point, and it's not negating anything else you're trying to do.
I think also, Scott, you wanted to get Roe into this story.
I was about to say, I wanted to use Ensign Roe.
So, yeah.
Sure. That was one of the things that I enjoyed reading the story, is that you did bring in, like, Ensign Roe and O'Brien pre-Deep Space Nine.
Yeah,
and kind
we thread the needle with that. There was a window where we could have both. We had to make sure our star dates lined up.
Yeah, and I thought it was a nice touch on your guys' part to kind of give O'Brien that subtle hint that maybe you don't want to be stuck in the transporter room all the time. Maybe you'd like to, you know, venture out and try something different.
Yeah. Yeah, I caught that too. I thought, what were we doing with that? And I realized, I think that's what we were doing with it.
Yeah.
That struck me when I, again, reading over this, and I think because it's been so long since these two guys have been actively lettering, but the lettering from Yataki and from Chris Mowry, I love it. I wish those guys were still lettering for IDW more.
Yeah, the lettering was very nice.
Yeah. Especially because this is another one of our early books where we were doing a lot more dialogue than we do now.
Oh, boy. The first couple issues, man alive, way too much dialogue. Some of the later ones, like, oh, boy.
Yeah, I felt sorry for poor Messina. Oh, look at all that artwork covering up with gigantic white bubbles. We got better at that.
Well, it was still early on in the writing career, so...
Yeah, I think we also had really realized how much we enjoyed more visual storytelling.
it's a problem because Star Trek is inherently very talky as it is, and so, but yeah, there's some pretty epic word balloons in here. That,
I think it took us a while to learn to thread that line between you have to have a lot of back and forth conversation in Star Trek. You can't not do it. But yeah, not as much as we did in these first couple of books.
Well, we'll start out with the first issue, which focuses on Riker and Data and the virtual reality story. How did you come up with the premise behind this first part?
In terms of the holodeck.
Just the idea of going to the Daystrom and what the problem they were having there.
I think that the biggest thing was because one of my favorite episodes is Measure of a Man. And yeah. So I was like playing with the Data Riker relationship, and it was finding something for them to do together that involved Data's expertise and Riker's command decisions. And so that was kind of my way into it, I think.
Okay.
That's about all I remember on that one too.
Yeah.
I think okay. I know we wanted to do a virtual reality type story, and we wanted to have some sort of large open space that they could move around, and I think that's how we came up with the Tesseract idea, which was looking at it now, it's kind of a little weird. I think that was the genesis of it, and I think we wanted. I'm pretty sure we specifically wanted to have a Riker and Data story. I think that was the real genesis of it too.
Okay, and one of the things I liked was that you kind of tease at the end with the Romulans with Tomalak. Their interest in Data, and my first thought is that Data is so super engineering wise that the Romulans would want him for the machine aspect of him, not necessarily for the reason that they want him at the very end of the story.
Yeah, that's actually that was a switch up I particularly enjoyed.
Yes.
I thought it would have seemed really sort of hackneyed if they just wanted to take him apart and build more of him. It's like, well, come on, we've already seen that kind of story before.
Yeah.
I just wanted the fact that they needed someone to help him out and they were too embarrassed to ask, which I thought was particularly Romulan.
Yeah, most definitely.
I really like the red herring aspect of that because with that ending, you think, well, obviously it's a we're going to find out what makes Data tick story, and that's not it at all. The Romulans are just screwed and need help.
Yep.
But we can never ask anybody for it.
Yep. So I thought that was a nice twist by the time you get to the end of the five issues. Now, the second issue is a Worf's story with a little bit of Ensign Roe kind of thrown in, which I think was my favorite of the parts just because, to me, it felt the most like a Next Generation episode where you would take a character and kind of explore something about them that the character sees it as kind of a weakness of theirs, but you do a nice job of twisting it to turn it into a positive.
Thanks. Yeah. With this one, I always thought that Worf and Ro are both the kind of people where, they have a hammer and every problem is a nail.
Yeah.
So I thought putting the two of them together, who else would Worf ask to back him up on this? Well, Ro, she thinks like I do. This will be great. And they can't do anything because they can't think outside that box. I really enjoy playing with that.
There was a particularly good, I'm looking at it from a collection that IDW put out a couple of years ago, which doesn't have all the covers. There was one really good cover of this one with the two warring entities up on the dam. Do you remember what I'm talking about, Scott?
Vaguely.
Yeah, and I thought that one kind of helped kind of tie that particular issue together.
And they didn't put the cover in the back?
This one they didn't, which is too bad. I don't see it anyway.
Huh.
This was really about being a war story more than anything else. That's mm-hmm. what I remember the most.
Yeah, that and also I at the time I was still watching a lot of the Next Gen had recently come out on either DVD or Blu-ray, so I was doing a lot of rewatching, and I hit a batch in a row of scenes where a crewman would have a problem or a dilemma, and Picard would just launch into this long parable. And I was always thinking, just tell me what you want to do. But instead, Picard would always tell a story and try to get that person to relate, to see his point. And I thought, yeah, that's how Worf would react to this. So without using that in here was mostly a reaction to me watching the episodes at the time.
Yeah, that was one of the questions I was going to have for you, is the kind of the lecture that Picard gives Worf about Talleyrand. How did you come up with bringing that character or that historical reference into the story?
Well, the idea for the bit between Worf and Picard, the actual conversation I think I came up with, but then the actual Picard's dialogue himself, that was all David.
Yeah, I seem to remember you told me what you wanted to do here, but we didn't have a hook.
Yeah.
And so for some reason, I've been reading some French Revolution history at the time, and so I pulled Talleyrand out of my hat, and it's like, okay. And it kind of fit in here. It's a little bit of a stretch, but I think it works. I mean, I think it's a good example of how you can use the way that Picard would sometimes let someone either succeed or fail before he steps in. And he's trying to let Worf succeed here. And he's trying to give him some help, but not give him too much help because he knows that that may not go over well with Worf either.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's also a nice reminder that, by the way, Picard is French.
So yeah.
Because it's Patrick Stewart, you always kind of forget that because they stopped having him curse in French after season one or two. So yeah. It's nice to have him. Well, French history, he'd be down with that. He would know some of that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I thought it fit in very well with, you know, what I would expect out of a Next Gen story, especially Picard and Worf, the kind of relationship they have. I could see Picard, you know, putting Worf into a situation where, okay, I want you to do this. And you might not feel like you're the best fit for it, but you will figure it out, and you will learn something about yourself by the time it's all said and done. And by Picard giving him this reference or this story, it made Worf kind of think about how he was handling the situation and what he might have to do to get it to reach a solution that would work.
Yeah. But the show is pretty good about showing Picard as kind of the best kind of hands-off manager.
Yeah.
Which you never saw with Kirk. Kirk's always just barreling right in and taking care of himself. And like David said, Picard will try and give his officers a chance to figure things out for themselves and trust them to do it.
Yeah, most definitely. Then the next story that we have is the story with the USS Jackson, the Excelsior-class ship, which I was kind of surprised to see an Excelsior-class ship in a Next Generation story.
They actually show up quite a few times. I think when we see McCoy appear in Next Gen, he's on one of those too.
Yeah, I think I remember reading that was one of the models they had handy that still looked really good. It's they got a lot of play.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Plus, I've always loved that ship.
Oh, yeah, me too.
And I was watching, I think, the beginning of The Child the other day, and I think there's an Excelsior class ship there as well. Actually, is it Excelsior class or is it Yeah, I guess that's right. So yeah, that was, and this story, this is kind of a tricky one. I think this one doesn't stand quite as much well as a story on its own, but it really leads to what the five story arc is.
There's a lot of plot service in this one. Yeah.
Yeah, and it really does say, okay, now we know there's something going on. Boy, I'd forgotten we put an Adosian in here.
yes, we did.
But that's not Eric's, right? We must have given him
a
different
name. No. It's just a different.
Okay. I was going to say, I don't think they lived that long.
I was happy to see this. The captain of the Jackson is it's Captain Travis, which was a tip of the hat to a good friend of mine, Travis Scott Bowden. And Messina even drew him in. So when you see him...
That's why he looks familiar.
Yeah, and he passed away this year, just a couple months ago. He was a really good friend of mine. And seeing him here in this book was a real surprise. It really made me happy. I'd forgotten we did that.
Well, that's awesome. Well, I really enjoyed the story. I was going to ask, the Mantlo wave, did you two come up with that, or was that something that had been in Star Trek lore before?
David, do you want to tell them, or should I tell them?
I don't remember.
The Mantlo wave is named after Bill Mantlo.
Is that a Bill Mantlo reference?
Yeah. Oh,
is
that,
goodness, okay. Yes.
Okay.
The creator of the Micronauts and ROM and the best writer of Marvel Team Up. One of our favorite Marvel writers. So,
yeah. Oh, yeah. I loved his work on Incredible Hulk and Alpha Flight.
Yep. Yep. Yeah. So that's a tip of the hat to good old Bill.
I got you.
For that. Okay.
Well, I thought this story I thought had a neat premise to it, that you know, the engineer of this ship sees something that nobody else is able to see, and it's up to Geordi and O'Brien to determine whether it's actually a real thing or not.
Yeah, and I like the notion that I don't think we, when I saw the character of, I think it's Engineer Carl, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. He's older than I think we initially intended him to be. And Messina makes him look like a guy almost at the end of his career.
Uh-huh.
But I think it actually kind of works there, because this is a guy who's been on a bunch of ships and seen a lot more stuff. And he's put on this kind of a younger hotshot crew where they think they know what's going on. And I mean, the notion of what happens with some of these Starfleet guys whenever their career starts to pan out, but they're still working with the best and the brightest. Are they going to be listened to? I thought that was an interesting thing to play with.
Yeah, I agree. You know, that's how I felt, was that seeing them as this older guy who has been around for quite a while, that he's somebody that the newer ones are going to say, oh yeah, or does he actually know what he's talking about? Is his old age kind of affecting his skills and abilities, and you know, is he just going slightly senile, slightly crazy, or should we actually believe what he's talking about?
Yeah. The other thing I noticed is, and again, it's funny to look back and look at this stuff. We had been reading a lot of Alan Moore at the time, because their sequence is like, it's a 2-page spread, and one page is Picard talking to Captain Travis, and one page is Geordi talking to Engineer Carl. And the layouts match each other. They mirror each other perfectly. And there's no way that was not by design. I think we've been reading a lot of Alan Moore. I know I had. And a lot of the things Alan Moore does where he'll mirror layouts on facing pages. As I came across, I was like, oh, wow, yeah, that's a League of Gentlemen thing we're doing there.
The other thing that I think I remember about this one is, for more than one of the issues here, we were trying to not have the ending be what you would necessarily expect. And in the last one, you know, we had kind of the bit of a twist there that maybe what happened wasn't quite what you expected. And at the end of this one, you expect that what's going to happen is that the devices there were actually some sort of a bomb. They're trying to sabotage the ship. And what turns out here is that it was just trying to point someone in this direction.
Yeah.
And I think that was one of the things that we'd come up with as the story went along, is that we needed to get across this idea. What would the Romulans do if they were trying to get someone to go there or go in a certain direction, or go a certain place, but they were hesitant or unwilling to ask for one reason or another? And so that's what came out of this story as well, is that it makes for an odd ending in a way, because you think, well, after all that, and they're just trying to like point them in a certain direction, that's sort of odd. And I think that was one of the elements here in this story also. It's like I was trying to not do the traditional, oh, there was a ticking bomb, and then you got to throw yourself in, someone's got to throw themselves on top of the bomb before it goes off, kind of a thing here. And I think we wanted something different.
Yeah. And like you said, at the end of this is where you kind of start getting into your subplot where, yeah, there's somebody leading them in a particular direction, and which leads into the next part that focuses on Counselor Troy and Dr. Crusher, and you bring in the Packleds.
Yeah, I'd forgotten we brought the Packleds in.
Yeah, those poor Packleds.
I forgot that we brought them in and just slaughtered them.
Yeah, exactly. I was happy to see it. It was like, oh, the Packleds. I like the Packleds. It's like, oh, no, they wiped them out.
No, both their appearance and their fate came as a surprise to me. I forgot to do that. The other thing, you could always tell if, no, because usually the way we write these things is we'll plot them out and then each take half, go write them separately, and then put it together. And a lot of times some of the details are a little bit on the lighter side, just kind of give each other room. And I think we were starting to do more of that here. Anytime you see star cartography, you know it's a me scene. Okay. I love star cartography and the fact that they introduced it in Generations and we'd never seen it before. And we only got to see it for that one movie and it was gone. So
yep.
I put in star cartography more than I should.
So, yeah, this story, you focus on Troy and Dr. Crusher, and Ensign Rolo shows up in this one as well.
Yeah, that was mostly because I wanted to do that Charlie's Angels cover.
Okay. Well, that makes sense. I was like, you're focusing on, like, the three power women of Next Gen.
Exactly.
And then, of course, you have them all brainwashed.
Yeah, well.
Yeah. And, man, Messina draws a pretty mean-looking Roe in Beverly. My goodness.
Yeah, but once they're brainwashed, they're bad news. And there's that one where Bev is punching poor DeCambra in the throat.
Yeah, no, and, I was just looking at that.
And her face is all in shadow. It's really kind of vicious.
Yep, with those mean-looking eyes. In fact, I'm on that panel right now, just you were talking about it. The other thing, this would be a good time to talk about David Messina's artwork. And one of the things that impressed me in this is, well, one of his artwork is really amazing all throughout this story. But anytime there's an action scene where there's like a fight scene going on, It almost jumps into it. Reading along in this, I felt a lot like watching an episode of Next Generation. However, not and don't take this as a knock on his artwork, but when he goes into a fight scene, all of a sudden it makes me feel like I'm reading a comic book again, because just the poses of the characters and how dynamic he does a really good dynamic character or a figure design throwing a punch or a kick.
Yeah, no, you would never see Deanna Troi look as badass as she does those last two panels. As far as the fighting stands. No, I hear you. And that is a tricky thing to do because, you know, the by nature, you kind of have to have a little bit more action in a comic. But yeah. TNG was not an action-heavy show. But yeah, this fight scene is almost Jack Kirby-ish.
Yeah.
One thing I did notice too about the art, this is less of a Messina thing, is it's a little darker than I would like color wise.
Well, you know what it is? Is there is a black framing of all of the issues.
That doesn't help. Right. Yeah.
Yep.
In fact, if you're looking at the large tray collection I'm looking at my now, if you look at it from the edge, you can see that the pages are black entirely all the way through. And so all the borders are black, which it gives the entire issue a certain kind of tone, which...
I think you're right, yeah.
I don't think I've seen IDW do that since.
Yeah, no, they used to do a lot on the Angel and Spike books.
Yes, they did.
But I don't think it serves Trek well.
No, I agree with you both there. To me, I'm looking at the Hero Collector version, and you can, especially with this one, because the Hero Collector one, at the end, they have a reprint of a Gold Key issue. And so if you look at it from the edge, you have all the black pages of the Next Gen story. And then you got a strip of white at the end where the Gold Key pages are. And it toned down the look of the story. Not only that, but there's an awful lot of black just within the panels themselves.
Yeah.
Of David's art, which the black outside of the panels really brings it that much darker.
Yeah. It makes the whole thing feel murky.
Yeah.
And it kind of does. It does Messina's art a disservice because he uses darkness well by intention. But then whenever you surround the whole thing in a black frame, it gets to be too much.
Yep. It makes it even more that way. But I'll say that the looks of the characters are spot on. He does a good job of varying the camera angles and you know, varying everything from distant shots to close-ups. And I enjoyed looking at his artwork all the way through.
By the way, I happen to own the original page where Worf and Data are wrestling Bev to the ground. And Data's like, I would not refuse assistance, Commander Worf. Unfortunately, not long after this, Messina had a fire in his studio and he lost almost all of his original art at the time.
Oh wow!
So I think I have the only original pages from this series that exist.
There's a lot. Oh. It's a shame. Yeah, but then we get to the finale, the final issue, and this is kind of where we find out where those devices came from and what this whole story with Tomalak and the Romulans are doing. This is where you have your big bad Buffy monster at the end.
Yeah. Oh, by the way, two more quick notes on the last issue is, you know, we get the Ferengi mind control device, which I love that thing. And also, yep. I'd forgotten we used Dr. Salar as well.
Yes.
Oh, yep. She snuck in there.
Yeah. But yeah. It's funny. I had never thought of the monster as being a Buffy monster, but it's totally a Buffy monster.
Yeah.
So how did you come up with the idea for the story of what the Romulans were doing and what they had going on?
I think the biggest thing was it had to be so bad they couldn't handle it. It's kind of a Romulan thing to stumble into that kind of thing by accident.
And I think at the time we had some discussions about there aren't a whole lot of monsters on this kind of scale in Star Trek.
No.
And so we kind of had something that was otherworldly or on another plane, on a dimension, because Star Trek isn't full of a lot of monsters like this. I mean, And I think we even thought about some big ones, like, you know, could we use the Borg? Could we use something like the crystalline entity?
I think we talked Nagilum.
Yeah, but none of those were big enough or really kind of the... None of those seemed like it would be completely out of the control of the Romulans. And it needed to be something that clearly the Romulans were so concerned that it might affect not only them, but it might be really bad.
Yeah.
And so... I think that's when we went down the road of, well, what about the Iconian dimensional portals? And what if something goes wrong? And maybe this can get us that kind of a monster. And we were pretty confident that Messina could do that kind of a monster.
Yeah.
And that's what we were gunning for. So I think once we lined those sort of things up, we thought, I mean, with a thing like this, we've got to make sure that it's something that will fit within a Star Trek canon. If we're doing something like a little stretching a little bit here, and so I think that's one of the things that made it come together.
I think for the most of the series, as we were coming along, we had no idea what this thing would be. We'll figure it out at the end.
Yeah.
I think we only even described it in our proposal to CBS as just the on the other side of the Iconian portal is something really bad, and I think that's all we actually had until we got here.
Yeah, the actual monster was developed kind of towards the end. And I think I don't remember how we described it to Messina exactly.
I think you said, no, because we had seen a lot of his Angel and Buffy or Angel work and other stuff. And this is the kind of monsters I think he's great at. He thrives
on.
I think we were counting on that part of it.
And we kind of knew in the back of our mind that we were confident that Messina could do what we needed for this.
Yeah, so
that
we told him big... insectoid, demonic, knock yourself out. And other than that, I think I gotta let him go with it.
Yeah.
Sometimes that's the best thing to do is just kind of say, you know, come up with something. Here's a general idea of what we're looking for. Come see what you can do, and just let the artist run wild with it. And as I was finishing reading this, one of the thoughts I had was, congratulations, guys! You were kind of a precursor to the Avengers movies.
Yeah.
Because it's kind of along the same things. A big dimensional portal opens up,
isn't it?
And monsters are coming out, and it's up to the heroes to get them back inside.
All the Tesseract talk at the beginning, I know. This is all before Avengers, right?
Yeah, it was almost like you tapped into the collective consciousness of the people at Disney making or at Marvel making the Marvel movies and got their ideas ahead of them.
I did like in this sequence that the one thing Data does manage to get going is the universal translator, which is the last thing you want to hear from this monster. And the panel, I mean, it's one of our gigantic word balloons, but on a face that's big, it's fine. And I just wanted the idea of hearing this guy's thoughts to be the most disturbing thing you could think of.
Yep. No, I thought that was really good.
Yeah, that was the intent.
And plus. We also got some Tomalak in here, which is always our favorite Romulan.
The one thing I'd forgotten here is on that next page over that the Centurion sacrifices himself in the way that he does.
I did too.
And I think we were kind of playing with what you'd seen with the Centurion in the original series. And this sort of idea of Roman self-sacrifice. Roman meaning Romulan here. So I think that was the intent with that, is that, well, this is what they would do. But it's also kind of funny that on the next page or so, Tomlach says, well, you know, if he dies, one of us is going to have to go next. So,
I was kind of wondering that, too, is if you had it planned to have the Centurion kind of sacrifice himself, or
that was a very late story idea, I'm pretty sure.
I'm not saying we paint ourselves into a corner, but it was a nice late idea to use. Yeah, because I always loved that relationship between the two Romulans in the very first TOS episode.
Sure.
And this is a nice tip of the hat to that.
Yeah.
Because it's easy to make the Romulans just always seem like venal smug jerks, but they do. But they do have a system of honor and a sense of kind of nobility of their own. And it's important to show the both sides of it, especially whenever our big ending is going to be Picard trying to give him a lecture about it. So yeah. you want to make sure they don't seem like just the complete fall guys here.
Yeah, I think that was a big part of it. I think we wanted to have a little bit of some, I don't know if I want to use the word salvation, but the Romulans had to come across as not complete jerks in this.
Yeah.
and I think that was a way to sort of convey it was also sort of a sign here that, okay, we know this is ultimately our responsibility and we are going to try to step up and do what we can about it, which I thought was important in this part of the story, because otherwise Tomlach here at the end, he's almost out of character. He's not acting with some of the elements that we have seen with Romulans in the past.
Yeah.
I'm noting here that the panel where we show the Centurion's death, despite being vicious, it's sudden. Like, all of a sudden, he's working away, and out of nowhere, this bug just shows up and just ventilates him. It's like, my God.
But he gets his hand up there just in time to hit the button.
No, the Messina did a great job with that.
Uh-huh. I thought it was a nice touch showing that the Romulans do have kind of a nobility or an honorability to them, that one of them is willing to sacrifice himself. At the same time, it counters the whole Romulan not willing to ask for help and doing all this underhanded stuff to lead the Enterprise where they needed to accomplish their goal in the end.
Yeah, there's a nobility, but it's a flawed nobility.
Yeah. So, all in all, I really enjoyed the story. Looking back on this story, is there anything that you guys would change as far as story-wise, or the beats of the story, or the parts of the story?
I'd take an editing tool to some of these giant word balloons.
there would be some editing. And also, this is not a knock on Messina, because Messina did a great job on this series. But I look at this, and then I look at what Messina did for us on Q-Conflict, and I couldn't help but think, man, what would 2020 Messina do with this story?
Yeah,
because his style has grown and developed so much over the years, and he still has his kind of that characteristic Messina style, but he's so much more versatile now.
Yeah, and that kind of goes hand in hand with the writing work that you guys do with him. You know, you all of you have grown from, you know, if you compare this story to more present work. You know, talking about cutting down the word balloons, you've kind of worked your way through and grown as writers to write more of a comic book style with less dialogue and still get your points across. And artists are always constantly evolving as their work continues throughout their career.
Yeah, I think we also hadn't realized quite yet at this point how big of a Star Trek fan the Messina was. Because back then we were still giving him just boatloads of research material.
Uh-huh.
And on Q Conflict, we were just naming alien races just casually, and he was just delivering them left and right. He really knows his stuff.
Well, that's good.
Yeah.
Well, not only that too, because you know, nowadays with so much stuff on the internet, even compared to 12 years ago, you can type in a alien race and Google something. Yeah. You'll come up with pictures and reference.
Yeah, that's the biggest thing. When we first started doing these, which wasn't all that long ago, there wasn't anywhere near the amount of image references there is on the web now. And so we used to have to supply artists with a lot of screenshots. That used to be a big part of my Scott and I would switch off, but I used to take a lot of time. I would go through and do a lot of screenshots off of DVDs.
You were doing a lot of that.
I was doing a lot of that because it wasn't really on the web, or if it was on the web, it was on these tiny little low-resolution images that weren't good enough for an artist to get a sense of what to do. And so even if there was stuff on the web back then, the images wasn't good enough. And nowadays, there's so much stuff out there. You can do a simple Google search, and you can come up with just about anything you need. And so we don't have to do it anywhere near as much as we used to do on that.
Back then, you had the faster computer with a bigger screen, and you're just naturally better at it than I am.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah.
You just picked up the ball.
I'd put the DVDs, and I'd go through, and I'd do a bunch of screenshots and put them all together into these large emails to send off to the artists. I mean, at the time, they really appreciated it because especially because I would go through and think, okay, look, we need to get a good enough screenshot that you can see some of the details of the special effects or the sets, because what you could find on the web back then, you weren't getting that kind of detail, and that was going to really show up if you didn't get that right in the art. So, yeah.
I remember the first couple of times we did that, we would get notes back from either Messina or Elena, like, no one ever does this for us.
I remember they
should be.
Well, at least that way, when you're supplying the reference material, you have a pretty good chance that you're going to see what you want to see in the final product.
Yeah, I mean, and more to the point, it makes them look better because no one's distracted by a visual continuity mistake.
Yeah, yep, very true. So, do you guys have any plans to tell any more Next Generation stories?
We have lots of plans.
Whether or not they actually see fruition, I guess.
There's lots of stuff for all kinds of different things, all in various stages of development. Future looks good.
Good.
Yeah.
That's good to hear. Well, Scott and David Tipton, I really enjoyed this story. You did an awesome job. I thought it was an excellent way to kind of showcase different characters in Next Gen and have this subplot that kind of ties it all up nicely in the end. And thank you for joining me today to talk about intelligence gathering.
Our pleasure.
Thank you.
Transfer of data is complete.
Huge thanks to Scott Tipton and David Tipton for taking time out of their schedule to chat with me about intelligence gathering. I know it was kind of taxing on them to think way back then to when they were still fairly young, fairly new writers who were working their way through IDW and writing lots of Star Trek. I think they did an excellent job on this story, and it was great to hear some of the behind the scenes of the making of this 5-issue miniseries, Intelligence Gathering. Thank you to you, the listeners, as well. Thanks for sticking with me. I know it's been a little while since our last episode, but it's been a really busy summer thanks to the coronavirus. At least for me, it has been. I hope this episode finds you safe and well. And until next time, this is Jeremy Bement saying live long, stay safe, and prosper. Thank you for downloading this episode of Star Trek Panel to Panel, the Internet's premier podcast about Star Trek comics. You can find us on Facebook at Star Trek Panel to Panel and on Twitter at Star Trek P2P, 2 being the number 2. You can always find Star Trek Panel to Panel wherever you get your favorite podcast, and can always find previous episodes on archive.org. Please let other Star Trek fans know about this podcast, and leave us a positive review on iTunes. Thank you for listening, and until next time, happy reading.